Welcome to the Commentary Magazine podcast. Today is Groundhog Day, February 2nd, 2017. I'm John Podhoretz, the editor of Commentary, the 72-year-old monthly magazine of analysis, commentary, opinion, criticism from a conservative perspective. Join our conversation at commentarymagazine.com, where we ask you to subscribe after we give you a few free reads. $19.95 gets you a digital subscription. $29.95 gets you an all-access subscription. People are joining up in droves. Join them. It's fun. We're good. It's provocative and interesting. And to continue with the provocation and interest, Noah Rothman, our assistant online editor. Hi, Noah.
Hi, John.
And Abe Greenwald, our senior editor. Hi, Abe.
Hi, John.
So the big news of the week in terms of the future history of the United States is the nomination of Neil Gorsuch to be the next Associate Justice of the Supreme Court, something that is almost certain to happen one way or another, either through a standard issue vote to close debate in the Senate after a confirmation hearing and visits and all that, and then a majority vote of Republicans, which will get him confirmed, or if Democrats refuse to allow such a vote to close debate, the likely blowing up of the filibuster rule that allows them to never allow a vote by Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, and the end of the potential for filibustering Supreme Court nominees pretty much forever. So Gorsuch will almost certainly be on the Supreme Court at some point, 49 years old, appellate court judge in Denver, extraordinarily impressive, very, 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 very good writer. I note with some solipsistic interest that he started a magazine at Columbia in the mid-80s, modeled somewhat on the magazine that I started with Todd Lindbergh at the University of Chicago in the late 70s. His was called The Federalist. Mine was called Counterpoint. There were two trends in the student publication business from a conservative perspective at the time. One was to go, shocking and anti-PC. That was the Dartmouth Review. The other was to go highbrow and sort of intellectually pristine, and that was Counterpoint and to some extent the Federalist, Gorsuch's publication. So, and here we have the two sides of Trumpism in some sense. Steve Bannon and Breitbart are somehow the ultimate intellectual, philosophical, and procedural heirs of the Dartmouth Review, and Neil Gorsuch, the Supreme Court nominee, is the ultimate commentary magazine nominee, let's say, in some ways, intellectual, serious, sober, somewhat playful at times, and very much committed to a philosophy of judicial restraint and originalism. Any thoughts, Noah, on where things go from here? Is it just an unalloyed sort of home run for Trump?
I think it's pretty much a home run for Trump. It should have been – he should have been able to coast on this one a little bit more. He has a unique penchant for stepping on his own message. But the reaction from the conservative right to this pick was pretty much universally acclaimed. And actually a lot of people were very quick to note that the quote-unquote never Trump right was very much wrong when it came to whether or not Donald Trump would adhere to his list of conservative judges. Gorsuch was a late addition, but he nevertheless did. He made good on his pledge to nominate a conservative originalist judge to the Supreme Court. That's going to be confirmed eventually. And some people were more gracious about this than others, but Never Trump Republicans do absolutely deserve some critique for not believing that Donald Trump would live up to his word in this case, and he absolutely has.
But did Never Trumpers say he would not, or that there was just no way to predict that
during
he would?
That's precisely it. During the campaign, they were concerned that he didn't mean a word of what he said, and as a result, how could you trust his list of judges? And you had people who were in his camp, particularly those who said the Supreme Court is the beginning, middle, and end of the argument for Donald Trump, said that it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what you think about him.
I mean, of course, the proof of the pudding will be in the eating as far as this goes in future, which is to say, this nomination does not change the balance of the Supreme Court in any way. This leaves it where it was, right? Because it's a trade of a Scalia disciple for the late Antonin Scalia. So the proof of the pudding again will be in the eating when it comes to the next Supreme Court choice. And there are rumors swirling all over Washington that someone is retiring at the end of this term. Thomas is one name. Kennedy is the other. Thomas, again, would not represent a shift in the balance of the court. Kennedy would represent a shift in the balance of the court if you chose somebody who was not a Kennedy but rather was a conservative.
And this is what I think is going to get interesting, is whether or not Democrats want to make the stand on this nominee, because their base absolutely does, and we can get into the details as to why, or whether or not they want to keep their powder dry for the next nomination fight, which is arguably, as you made that case, going to be a much more consequential fight.
But also, just to go back to the other point about predicting what Trump would do, if it's Kennedy and that comes up, are we now so enlightened and confident that Never Trumpers were so wrong about Trump's instincts that Trump supporters are certain that.
Well, let's put it this way.
Who is the second judge, though? The second judge was a little less conservative, as far as.
People who are much more ideologically in sync with the Federalist Society position think that Judge Hardiman, who was apparently the runner up and who apparently played along with the White House with this game where he took a drive from his home in Philadelphia to a friend's house in Altoona to increase the heightened drama of whether or not there were going to be two people, you know, still in contention. Presumably Judge Hardiman did that because he was told that if he remained friendly with the White House, maybe the White House would remain friendly with him at a later date and bestow the next rose upon him. But there was some talk that he wasn't as good as Gorsuch, let's say.
Donald Trump's sister.
Well, because he's on the court with Donald Trump's sister. That's why. And so she might have said to him, look, if you're going to pick a conservative, you should pick Hardiman. He's a great guy. So I think the interesting circumstance with Trump as a leader and as a president is for which he should be given credit by the right. And I would say that, of course, if he made a brilliant choice, if, you know, Gorsuch proves to be a, you know, brilliant member of the court for 30 years, he should get all due credit should go to him. But, you know, if any Republican had won the presidency in 2016, you can bid fair to say that he would have chosen Gorsuch or a Gorsuch-like person and that the feeling would be the same. We've had examples, eccentric examples, like, you know, President Bush's decision to try to name Harriet Myers to the extraordinarily advised decision to name his friend Harry Myers to the Supreme Court, which got knocked off. And we have, you know, Ronald Reagan, the most conservative president ever, you know, made three nominations to the court, and two of them did not turn out to be down-the-line conservative, to put it mildly, right? That Scalia was, but Sandra Day O'Connor certainly wasn't. And Anthony Kennedy certainly wasn't. And on the hot button issues of our time, you know, gay marriage and abortion, and they were not reliable votes for the, you know, right wing view on these culture war matters. So, you know, whereas George H.W. Bush, who was, of course, a, you know, not a reliable conservative, made the, what I think even he would think was the disastrous decision to pluck this obscure New Hampshire jurist at the advice of his extraordinarily arrogant and pompous White House Chief of Staff, John Sununu, up, you know, who would claim never to have had a conversation in his entire life or a thought about abortion, David Souter, who turned out to be a very liberal member of the court, and Clarence Thomas, who turned out to be Clarence Thomas.
So I wrote a piece yesterday that I think is going to be – the themes of it are going to matter. You said that we had seven members of the Senate who are Democrats who are going to essentially vote for cloture and let this nomination go by. Those are – I found the names. They're Dick Durbin, Richard Blumenthal, Coons, Heitkamp, Manchin, McCaskill, and Tester. Now, with the exception of Durbin, all of them are up in 2018.
And they are all 2018, and they are all in states that went for Trump.
With the exception of Coons, Blumenthal.
Right, Coons, excuse me. Coons and Blumenthal are not. That's right.
Heitkamp, Manchin, McCaskill, and Tester. Now, somebody has to be the eighth vote, who will be the vote to confirm Justice Gorsuch. And
remember, this is not a vote to confirm. The Senate has a two-tiered system. Just to explain for 5 seconds. So the Senate has a system called unlimited debate. There is no time limit on the debate on any question before the Senate on the floor. And so the only way that debate can be ended and a vote can the roll can be called to call a vote is for something to be introduced called cloture, which ends debate at the willingness of the senators to end debate. And according to Senate rules governing all legislation and Supreme Court nominations, but no longer governing executive branch appointments and judges below the Supreme Court level, 3/5 of the Senate must vote for cloture, 60 votes. So no one expects that Gorsuch would get 60 votes on the floor of the Senate to be confirmed as the next Associate Justice, but if the regular order of the Senate as it now stands is to stay, a vote to close debate will have to happen. 7 Democrats have now said they will join 52 Republicans in doing that. So one more vote is needed to close debate to allow the vote.
Right. So ultimately –
and this is all, by the way, speculative in the sense that, you know, in theory, Gorsuch could go before the Senate Judiciary Committee for his confirmation hearings, sure, and say that, you know – and say that he, you know, supports polygamy, and that could be the end of that. But
well, the public's not going to follow along with that. They're going to know that somebody was the deciding vote for this thing. Like, we know that every single member of the Senate in 2010 was the deciding vote for Obamacare.
Right.
They were the last vote, the one vote, and that's what they're going to run on. So if this becomes an issue, and it probably will because Democrats have convinced themselves that any collaboration with this administration is tantamount to rolling over for a Vichy regime and representing a fascist takeover of America, done probably real damage by an interesting report today by Alana Goodman, who indicated that in Justice Gorsuch had a bizarre club that was named Fascist Forever or something like
that. No, if you were a conservative in the early 80s, you told jokes about how, if you're going to call me a fascist, then fascism forever.
Yeah,
like, so he had a club called Fascism Forever, which indicated that he was like an ideological conservative at his liberal Jesuit high school.
It's clearly tongue-in-cheek, but there is no room for humor on the left. Everything is 100% serious and dire. And so we have the conditions for Democrats to be really tortured by the nascent formation of something resembling a Tea Party, which will demand of them to drive at full speed into brick walls the fighting of already lost battles. For example, forcing Republicans to change the rules in order to confirm a Supreme Court justice. That would be a disaster for Democrats because they're going to need dry powder the next time another justice comes up, even if it's before 2018 and probably before 2020, when the next time they might have even the prospect of retaking the Senate. So Democrats don't want to have a real big fight over this, but their base sure does. And if Democrats facing their primary electorates go home and have to say, yeah, sure, I confirmed this justice, and their really tiny population in red states, their small, sequestered, possibly more radicalized population of primary voters doesn't like that decision, you have the conditions for a Democratic movement akin to what happened in 2010 to Republicans.
Well, I hear very few Democrats talking about keeping their powder dry. I mean, it's mostly sort of
no, because the base would freak out
right
about it.
Right, and now, in fact, the new term I'm now hearing constantly is fascism is somewhat out. It's coup. There's a coup afoot. A coup is taking place, and of course, when a coup is taking place, then obviously, you know, it's all at war at all times.
Who's behind the coup?
Well, I know Mike.
No,
Michael
Trump's
Moore.
The coup.
Right.
Trump is the coup.
Right. Right, I know Michael Moore.
I don't know how he can
put
be the coup when he was legitimately elected the president of the United States, but that's the coup because they are stupid and use idiotic language,
right,
to describe themselves like the resistance, you know, which is stupid. So you're not the resistance; you're the opposition, and the opposition is very powerful in a democratic and Republican society, and right. you can do a lot of you can oppose very effectively.
Yeah, I know. I mean, of all people, Michael Moore, because he, you know, before the election had I don't know if he predicted Trump's win or said it's certainly possible. Whatever, he's riding whatever.
Slim.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And he's saying things like, don't pay attention to this, don't pay attention to that. All this is to distract you from the coup that is taking place right before our face.
Yeah, there is so much of this. There is so much of this idea that, you know, everything that's going on is, you know, they Trump blows up one story in order to distract you from the other one, which is more important. And, of course, the more important story is always the one about which the person who is making the argument has a total bugbear in their, you know, like in their bonnet about it and like is completely obsessed with and thinks everybody should be as obsessed with it as they. Whereas, in fact, what I think is now pretty clear after 2 weeks of this administration is that they had this idea that coming in, what they wanted to do was shock and awe, and they were just going to do a lot of stuff all at once, and they weren't properly staffed up, and they didn't have enough people, and they didn't have enough clearance, and you know, rather than do this in an orderly, stately procession, which was given to them, permitted to them by the fact that that Republicans had control of the House and Senate, and therefore there was no rush to get everything done. In fact, politically, you could do it, you could lay it out in a magisterial fashion because you knew you had congressional support, you know, by default. And that shock and awe is often something you need to do when you're like, when you need to trip up your opposition and send them reeling. And that's not really exactly what's happened. I mean, again, we have this huge debate going on the right about whether or not the left has lost its mind or whether Trump has like awakened a sleeping beast or done something to help create the accelerant for a really serious opposition movement, grassroots movement against him. And I continue to see no evidence that, you know, the left has just lost its mind any worse than the right has lost its mind or everybody has lost their mind. Everyone is losing their mind right now. So I think that's just a precondition. You know, people on the right say they don't believe news stories, and people on the left say that everything is fascism. And that doesn't mean that, you know, once again, as we said over on the last podcast, getting, you know, 25,000 people to go to airports in the middle of the weekend on a Saturday night isn't an impressive display of grassroots organizing force that can have an enormous impact in 2010 if it can get properly focused and channeled.
Well, I think also adding to this, the atmosphere that you're describing is something that you had mentioned before we started the show, which is that also every story now comes out in iterations. There's versions of every breaking story, and by the way, that happens on both sides. That's the media is their reports come out in a series of sometimes contradictory revelations. And the administration is telling successive stories about policies as well.
Two things on that. One, the iterations thing isn't new. We've always had, you know, stories that are built upon with contradictory information that gets, you know, corrected. It's just that in the nature of this current media environment with the technological advent of social media, for example, is that we're aware of all these iterations as they come out. And normally these things have time to ruminate in a newsroom before they're disseminated.
Right.
Secondly, there might be a real tactic there when it comes to this administration's approach to antagonizing the press. And I wrote about this in an upcoming piece for USA Today, actually. That the nature of the administration seems to be that they put out these like contradictory and vague pronouncements, and then sort of let it roll around in the press, and then somebody comes out and clears away the fog and sagaciously chides the press for their failing their audience and for bias and for, you know, serving the administration's desire to have an opposition figure in the form of the media. It seems as though this happens too often to be an accident.
Well, I don't know if it's sagacious, because I don't think that any person on the planet Earth would describe Sean Spicer, the White House press secretary, as sagacious, including himself. I mean, he is like a character out of Richard Brinsley Sheridan play. I mean, every sentence of his contains a malapropism. So, I don't think his sagacity is his strength, as befits the person who started yelling at the media for using the word ban in relation to the travel ban that his own boss had used 3 hours earlier in a tweet in relation to the travel ban, that the use of the word ban was biased when it was being used by the White House itself in the person of the President of the United States. So is that sagacious?
Perhaps
I don't
think that
is sagacious.
Credit. I believe that's the effect he's going
for. But let's move on. But
for.
Let's move on then to some of the other topics because they connect to this issue, like this late-breaking scandal overnight about the fight between Trump and the Prime Minister of Australia over the 1,250 refugees currently at an offshore site off Australia.
Well, there are two fights.
There are two fights, excuse me.
There's the Australia fight and the Mexican fight.
Right, and the Mexican fight, right. Well, so basically, you know, we are told that Trump is having these very ugly phone calls with, you know, with world leaders. And then we realize as things go on that the people who are telling us that Trump is having these ugly phone calls are Trump and his people. Like, they want us to know that he's yelling at the Australian Prime Minister and hanging up the phone on him. Ordinarily, this would not be the case. You wouldn't want public – you might say use some kind of euphemism like we had a frank exchange or something like that. Certainly not a term you would use with allies, hardly ever. But the Noah and Abe, you both believe that this is part of a deliberate strategy to send messages to the American people that Trump isn't going to take any guff from any of these – you know, foreigners, basically, right?
Yeah, most definitely. And that's backed up by the video we just saw prior to coming in here where Trump had said, look, you're hearing about these rough phone calls. Don't worry. Don't worry about it. We've been the U.S. has been taken advantage of by country after country, and that's going to stop
by nearly every country. We've been taken advantage of by nearly every nation in the world, and that's going to stop.
Yeah, I think that they...
Now, to whom is that directed? Who does... And again, this gets to the interesting point that I keep pressing with no... You know, I mean, we'll see what happens. But I understand that in the world of the extreme nationalist, the President of the United States saying, we've been taken advantage of by every country and I'm going to stop that. Is the sort of thing that leads them to go, yay, finally someone's, yay, well, you know, we got a president who has our back. But he only got 46% of the vote. And the harder that he hits and the harder that he aligns himself with, you know, the people who will be with him in any case, the question that arises is he making it more and more difficult for people who, even like the soft people who voted for him but voted for him softly, as well as the people who didn't vote for him, to rally to his side, you know, when the chips are down and when the country really needs to unify?
I think he probably is, but he's not if he is getting his opposition so crazy that they misstep and make themselves less appealing. I mean, I think that's the hope.
I agree with that. I mean, what in these phone calls would he be ashamed of? The idea that he's pushing around the Mexican president and toying with the idea of deployments, according to the Associated Press, of deployments to get a handle on the Mexican cartels, which are attacking tourist areas now. Who in the West Wing is going to be frustrated by the idea that Donald Trump is seen as tearing up these agreements from the Obama administration for which we have to accept 1,200 or so refugees from these countries that he just banned refugees from? Who in the West Wing is going to be upset by this? Nobody. And frankly, I don't think the public is all that upset by it either, including people who didn't vote for Donald Trump. The refugee ban wasn't really unpopular. I think the way it was implemented probably made more enemies than would otherwise have been because it created a bunch of victims out of children and old people and American citizens. With terrible optics probably made people more upset with it than they otherwise would have been. But American people don't love taking in refugees. They never have. Similarly, they're not very thrilled about the prospect of a failed state on the southern border, and I don't know if they would be all too upset about the idea of deployment.
Okay, let me fight back against this. You think the American people don't look, and you know, America loves Australia. Like, what do we have against Australia? Everybody loves Australia.
It's not about Australia. It's about this refugee agreement.
No, but it's secondarily, no. It's about this refugee agreement. This is the question you have to ask yourself is, are people going, what's he fighting with Australia for?
He made it very
This is
much.
A little bit like Obama. I'm sorry, this gets to, you know, the main controversy. One of the main controversies of the Obama foreign policy was his fighting with Israel. fact is that a lot of people in the United States who like, you know, Israel is liked by, you know, 60% of the American people are like, what is he fighting with Israel for? And simultaneously, if he's going to fight with Israel, he's going to fight with Australia, and he's going to play footsie with Russia.
Conservatives had just as big a problem with Obama's antagonism toward the UK.
Right. So I'm saying, like, you're going, what's he fighting with Australia for?
Yeah, and
the more you know, the more horrifying it is. I mean, you know, Australia's fought in every war with us. You know, Australia's, there are Australians in Afghanistan right now fighting alongside us. Like, this is one of our closest allies.
I'm taking the devil's advocate position, but I am noting that the refugees themselves, not Australia, the source thereof, these refugees themselves are what people are legitimately nervous about.
I understand. But, you know, the thing is that he made this very much not about the policy. He made it about the quality of the relationship. He said things like, I spoke to three other world leaders today, and this is by far the worst phone call I've had with any of them. He shut it down early.
That's the highest insult, by the way. I don't like this phone call, therefore you should be ashamed.
Nobody.
But look, I'm even willing to believe that it was a bad phone call, and maybe Turnbull, the Australian Prime Minister, is a jerk and said the wrong things to him and pushed his buttons and acted in a weird way. And maybe even the fact of this agreement that Obama entered into after the election was intended as a giant middle finger to Trump, if you really think about it. Because what is Obama doing exactly? Saying, yeah, I understand you got a problem with your refugees because you don't have a good place to house them, you know, Prime Minister Turnbull. So tell you what, we'll take them. Like, what's he doing that for? Those refugees came to Australia on a boat because Australia had an open refugee program that Turnbull was elected in part to get rid of. So he doesn't like the refugees. And he said to Obama, I don't like that. Obama was like, sure, give them to me. Fine. What the hell? He wasn't even going to be president when the refugees got to the United States. So you have to wonder in some sense whether this wasn't just like one of these like hilarious middle fingers from Obama to, you know, like a slow acting stink bomb in that was going to hit. And we know, as we were debating for half an hour here, that the executive order he signed on the refugee ban on Friday had this half sentence specifically exempting the deal with Australia from the refugee ban. Now, the question is, who put it in there? Obviously, Trump had a tantrum because he didn't know it was in there after he signed it. And then somebody said, you're having this call with Australia. And by the way, you know, the refugee ban, one of the things in the deal was we exempted this. We're taking 1,250 refugees from Australia. And he said to Turnbull on the phone call, this is going to kill me with my base, essentially, he said, because it looked hypocritical. So the question is, who put it in there? You know, we know that a lot of people on Capitol Hill were helping draft the executive order, helping their friend Stephen Miller, the Jeff Sessions aide, and signing non-disclosure agreements about who did it. Which I presume they did because they'd rather work in the White House than work on Capitol Hill, as most people in Washington would. And they were trying to do a solid so they would get themselves a nice job. And somebody stuck a sentence in there exempting Australia and didn't tell Trump until after the fact.
Well, and going forward, true to form, Trump has been vague about it, but not only about what's going to happen next regarding Australia. You know, he said, I intend to act in accordance with my obligations, but I'm going to put them through extreme vetting. But that goes also. I mean, when he sort of threatened or half threatened to send the military into Mexico, what is it really? What is he really going to do that? He's not going to.
Want boots on the ground.
Right,
anywhere.
Right. And by the way, this also goes. If we can just add on to the discussion of Trump and foreign policy. Mike Flynn's statement about Iran. What is being put on notice mean? This is another vague Trump formulation.
Right.
That has
so we put Iran on notice. Yeah. Some press asked, since Flynn said it at a press briefing, press said, what does Flynn mean by putting him on notice? And then Spicer said, well, there'll be a press briefing on this at 4 o'clock, and there was no press briefing. So we don't know what it means because probably General Mattis said, what the hell are you doing? Putting them on notice. What does that mean? What, you're just going out there and saying we're putting them on notice? Like this
to the extent that we have any concrete action, it was yesterday the United States requested that the United Nations engage in emergency consultations because the White House regarded this as a violation of United Nations Security Council prohibitions on Iranian missile testing. And that was something that the Obama administration swore up and down that the Iranian missile tests were not a violation of UN sanctions and certainly not of JPOC, the Iran deal. So this is a big change and shift in policy. And
by the way, it's a welcome shift in policy because of course the Iranians if they're testing ballistic missiles are violating the terms of the Security Council resolution and the joint agreement, and Obama wasn't going to do anything to step on this, and they've been doing it and doing it and doing it. And it's good they're put on notice. It just means you got to tell them what the notice
Another
is.
Another refreshing thing. That
what is
came
it?
Out
double.
Of,
it's now they're on double secret probation.
Another refreshing thing out of that Flynn presser was his unequivocal linking of the attack on a Saudi frigate by the Houthi militias who are in control of Sana'a with the
Sana'a's in Yemen.
Sana'a's the capital of Yemen. They're not in control of all of Yemen, but most of it. And Iran. And these are Iranian proxies. They're sponsors. They're armed, funded, and supported by Tehran. And the Obama administration, American ships were under attack by the Houthi militias. And the Obama administration sort of pretended that these two things were distinct. Even to the extent when he got an authorization to use force in Yemen, there was linking between the Houthis and Iran. And now there is. We're being very clear and plain about that, and that's great. Russia isn't very happy about this, though.
Right, and there's the other test, right? Because now it appears that Russia is turning up the heat in Ukraine with the buddy-buddy talk out of the White House nonetheless. So Russia may feel emboldened to start making its move on consolidating its control using these so-called anti-government rebels who are basically Russians in disguise, Russian soldiers in disguise, to try to take over chunks of neighboring Ukraine. And we also have word that Vladimir Kara-Murza, who is a democracy, anti-Putin democracy activist for the Open Russia group that's funded by Putin rival Kvaratskhely, that he has now been poisoned a second time. That he this is one of Putin's favorite ways to off people is to radiate them with poison, and it appears that that's been done a second time, and we still haven't had the famous meeting call, whatever, of the minds of the two great friends of the 21st century, Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin.
Well, they did have a call on Sunday.
Right.
And that was what a lot of people thought was a weird prelude to this uptick in violence in Ukraine. And there are a lot of theories as to whether or not this was Donald Trump's and Vladimir Putin's phone call leaving Vladimir Putin to feel emboldened, so he's testing the defensive parameters of the West and by turning up the temperature in Ukraine, or he's kind of frustrated by the fact that the White House hasn't removed these sanctions like they said they were going to do very early on in the administration, so we're trying to send a very unsubtle signal there. And the fact that Russia's been pretty plainly frustrated with the idea that we're putting Iran on notice, their functional allies, suggests that maybe there is a bit of a falling out between this White House and Moscow.
And it's worth it's worth noting that all the other international phone calls were leaked like crazy. We know all the explosions and the fights and the fireworks. We're left guessing at the Trump Putin call.
Right. The final story we should talk about is the distressing events in Berkeley, California, Wednesday night when college Republicans foolishly invited the infamous Milo Yiannopoulos, the Breitbart alt-right provocateur, gay, flamethrower, total opportunity offender, claiming that he's speaking for anti-PC and for free speech, a very silly and not a very good person, and someone who should not be invited to places where better people should probably be invited, nonetheless was shouted down. The idea of his speaking was met with Molotov cocktails and firebombs. Berkeley canceled the event, and then the protesters began marching through the town, smashing windows, breaking cars, assaulting people. absolutely horrendous moment, one of those, yet another horrendous moment in the annals of this war on free speech by the left, which has now decided that offensive speech is not protected by the First Amendment, nor does it require their support, and that it is perfectly fine for them to use illegal tactics to silence people. The question is whether those tactics, the things that they are doing, will be self-defeating, or whether they are all part and parcel of this uprising against Trump. Like, you know, will good-thinking people on the left say this is terrible, the way David Simon, the creator of The Wire on Twitter this morning, engaged in fights with fellow leftists about why you're not supposed to shout people down and you know, destroy cars because someone says something you don't like? Or are they going to say, well, this is the cost of Trump did this, and this is all Trump's fault, and this is all the alt-right's fault, and I'm, you know, punch a Nazi is fine with me, and everything is great. So I don't really know, to be honest. I think you can't, in some sense, on the left, have a real, you know, sort of like grassroots movement that doesn't contain some element of violence. That's what the 1960s showed us and were all about. But whether or not that ends up being self-defeating and helps Trump more than it hurts him, I don't know.
Yeah, I think there are more good people on the left than there are violent agitators.
Way more.
Many of them are very deeply disturbed by what they saw last night. Fewer are, I think, disturbed by what you had referenced there, which was an event in which Richard Spencer, I believe his name, who's sort of become a leader of the alt-right, a member of a very white nationalist element of the alt-right, outspoken white nationalist element of the alt-right. And he was doing an on-camera interview recently on Inauguration Day, I believe, and somebody in the crowd just came over and just cold-cocked him in the face. Sucker punched him. And this was not met with the revulsion of the civilized America. For the most part, a lot of people began to engage in a genuine debate over whether or not it was appropriate to punch Nazis, self-described. Richard Spencer is not a self-described Nazi, by the way, although he is a white nationalist. And to the extent that this ended up in the New York Times, where we had a real debate in the New York Times about whether or not it's okay to physically assault somebody. And that's the tenor of the debate that we're at, where we're actually having a real conversation about whether it's okay or not to engage in battery. And that, in the name of some sort of a political ideal to oppose fascism. All you have to do is label something fascism and violence is justified. And that's the sort of the tone where we're at on the left, and it's rewarded. We can't pretend that this isn't rewarded by popular culture, by the members of this quote-unquote resistance.
But I agree that a huge majority of the left is not in favor of these things and is full of nice people and thoughtful people and whatever else. But I think that the prevailing sense of revenge on the left, and by the way, revenge on the right in the election of Trump, has a lot of people not thinking straight, not thinking clearly. And I think they are at the very least seduced by the sort of catharsis of these things.
Right. Well, I think the idea is this. Trump is not normal, so therefore you have to respond to him in a not normal way. That's the idea. So you are without God, everything is permitted, and with Trump, everything is permitted. So Trump, so you can engage in acts that are violent or shouting down or whatever because look how terrible Trump is.
Indeed, to fail to engage in that is to display a lack of zeal that betrays perhaps your lack of enthusiasm for the cause.
That's right. Now, but the dark thing that I was trying to reference before is it may be that this is a part of the accelerant that the left needs to get itself organized to defeat Trump, in a more civilized way. I don't really know. We'll see how that goes. But it can also be the kind of thing where more rational people say, look, we can go down this road, but that's really stupid. Let's get ourselves, let's get ourselves congressional candidates in every district. Let's get ourselves, grassroots movements against every piece of legislation, every this, every that, Neil Gorsuch, whatever, and, work through the system and use the strength of the system to help defeat the people and the ideas that we don't like.
They don't want to work within the system. They believe that working with people like this who are engaged in this kind of violence, they believe that the system itself has failed. The system allowed somebody like Donald Trump to become the president of the United States. The system is the enemy.
Right.
That's the sort of thing that needs to be
And
frankly, this is something else that I had written about before, which is there is this academic culture which sort of equates violence with activism and like zeal, and it's therefore an acceptable element of political discourse. This is something we've been writing about for a long time.
Right, but that's what I'm saying. The question is whether when it comes to the left, whether this is an important element or a necessary element of any kind of mobilization, just and has been now really since the mid-60s, which is to say it should be disqualifying and discrediting, but it may literally be a sort of I don't know what you call it, one of those things that happens in a chemical process when...
Catalyst?
Not a catalyst, the opposite. Like whatever falls to the side, the junk that the junk that is created nonetheless on the side.
Byproduct.
Right. Thank you very much for the vocabulary lesson.
I'm rewatching Breaking Bad.
There we go.
But on the catalyst point, though...
A secondary byproduct.
Might this not be a catalyst for a coming fracture on the left? Where there are the people who continue to say the system is the problem, playing by the rules is the problem, and then there are the more thoughtful people who say, no, we have to go about this from within the system.
But the question then is whether they unite. I mean, the real question is, and there's been a lot of this on the left too, which is, oh, so you, Susan Sarandon, you said that Clinton was worse than Trump. And now you're saying resist Trump. Well, where were you when Clinton needed you? And where were you Bernie bros who like made big fights over the summer? Where were you when we needed you? When the fact is that there was this great mortal danger in the person of Trump. Why didn't you unite better? Where's the necessary enthusiasm that we needed there? And there is a kind of question, a scolding question that will prove whether or not essentially the liberal left is ready to deal with the fact that it is very disappointing in American politics that when you need to oppose and you need to unify, against something you believe is a greater threat, sometimes you have to make unpalatable choices because those are the only choices that you got. And whether they'll learn that lesson for 18, which is the real question, or for 2020 is something we just don't know.
You know what I think doesn't bode well is that the thing I keep hearing on both sides, on the left and right now, is we've been too nice. We need to play like the other guys.
It is amazing how everyone says this. But people have been saying it forever. It's like, it's like the Rumble song in West Side Story. They began it, and we're the ones who'll stop it once and for all. Tonight, so everyone, but those guys, they're serious. Yeah. They're really serious, and we really need to stop.
Until we get serious like that, they're going to keep walking all over us.
Yeah. That's the mentality that the right fell for when they fell for Donald Trump, but he fights. That was the mantra.
Yeah,
at least he fights because Republicans just roll over for Barack Obama, whatever he wants.
Yeah,
Barack Obama got everything he wanted from 2011 to 2017.
Yeah, which is to say nothing. He got absolutely
nothing.
He never got anything
that Barack Obama wanted, and yet
he never got anything.
But that's the same mentality that's going to take over the left, and that's what I was writing about with this whole sort of nascent Tea Party simmer that's going on under the surface and sort of bubbling up on the surface now on the left, is that any compromise, any willingness to display an interest in governing in cooperation with Republicans and Donald Trump is tantamount to treason.
Yeah, well, there's no interest in governing. The idea will be to throw your stick into the spokes of government, because whatever Donald Trump does to govern is by definition, by now, it's only we're 2 weeks into this administration and the terms are set. Like anything he does is evil. And therefore anything that you do to stop him is fine. And nonetheless, a lot of this depends on it's interesting because a lot of this presumes that all of the steady working levers of government just sort of go on by entropy. Even if you stage this kind of attack, Social Security checks go out, unemployment checks go out, your Medicare, your Medicaid runs smoothly, and, everything, the military gets paid, and everything functions while you say that nothing else should happen. And if you have a culture in which the idea is that nothing should be allowed to go forward, you're going to have government shutdowns, you're going to have, that whatever can be done will be done to throw you know, to throw wrenches in the works. And in fact, the more that happens, the less likely it is over time that the elemental working functions of government are just going to go on the way they did before. I mean, this is a way of hastening a kind of functional systemic collapse. And a lot of us objected to the Tea Party. The Tea Parties are not the Tea Parties, but sort of like the right's obstructionist tactics in 2011 and 2013 as members, as conservatives, precisely for this reason, which is we did not vote for government to turn into a, you know, what the good working order of the country is what matters here. And it was very important to stop Obama, but it's not important to stop, you know, meeting your national debt payments, for example, because that goes to the full faith and credit of the United States. But that argument was lost on the right, and apparently it's now been lost on the left as well. And so everybody believes the other guy is illegitimate. And, you know, we'll see. We'll reap the whirlwind from that, I think. But you will not reap the whirlwind from us any longer, because it is time for us to draw a veil upon this second podcast of the week. Thank you very much for listening. Please subscribe at iTunes. Come read commentarymagazine.com and subscribe to our magazine. For Abe Greenwald and Noah Rothman, I'm John Podhoretz. Keep the candle burning.